What is up out there? Welcome to the Bar Podcast. I am Jimmy Davis. This is probably going to be a relatively short episode because recording and trying to get the show posted has really become a challenge lately. And if you've noticed, because I haven't really been releasing a weekly episode. So it's been 2 weeks since I did a show, and it was 3 weeks before that. So obviously, the timing and the time that it takes me to put together an episode is challenging. But what I do want to talk about is some of the things I do have planned for the show over the next little while, and especially in light of what we are seeing happening right now in the country. I'm going to do a series of episodes that talks about impeachments, and so what led up to them and what they were about, and ultimately what the articles of impeachment were. Now, we've never had a president removed from office due to impeachment, but we have had we've had two impeachments in the history of the country, but we almost had a third, and that was Richard Nixon, of course, who resigned before he was impeached, and he probably would have likely been the first that was actually removed. And so, the similarities we are seeing today compared to what we saw 45 years ago is pretty extraordinary. And I don't think people realize that. And, you know, and also another thing I want to talk about in future episodes is conspiracy theories and the psychology behind conspiracy theories. You know, my big take on conspiracy theories is that the psychology of it is you're trying to explain something to either meet a preconceived notion that you have, in other words, cognitive dissonance, right? Or to try to explain a traumatic event. So there's always there's conspiracy theories surrounding 9/11, the assassination of JFK, you know, just some of these traumatic things as to why they happen. Even the death of Elvis. I mean, people still think Elvis is alive today, and there's theories behind that. But then you also have the theories like, you know, the flat earthers and those kind of people, which are few and far between. There's not as many of those as there are people that believe in conspiracies that have to do with politics and that have to do with traumatic events such as 9/11, such as assassinations of presidents. So again, I think that that's something worth exploring, though, because it kind of puts things into context of things today, because there are conspiracy theories going on right now in terms of the fallout from the Russia investigation and why the State Department is acting the way it's acting, and why President Trump was investigated in the first place. It was to cover up things. I've always loved these conspiracy theories that have to do with government, because the people that have these conspiracy theories against government and that they're ruling our lives and blah, 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 are also the ones that the first ones to complain that government is completely incompetent. If they're so incompetent, how are they getting away with this stuff? And if there was a conspiracy to get Hillary Clinton elected, and they're smart enough to get away with these other conspiracy theories that you kooks believe in, then how the hell did they allow Donald Trump to win the election? If they're that smart, if they're that savvy, and they're that underhanded, they should have had no problem turning the tides of an election. Unless we're saying, maybe the thought is then that Russia's just smarter than our government officials that tried to swing things in favor of Hillary Clinton. But oh wait, the people that believe that there was a conspiracy to try to get Hillary Clinton elected couldn't possibly believe that, because they don't believe there was Russian interference to begin with. And now, of course, we've heard just today that there's more stuff about Michael Flynn, and the president is starting to tweet about that. What the hell was Donald Trump so worried about that he tried to get people to lie, and he wanted to know what was going on in the investigation? He was so wanted to be in the know. Why was that? Was it because he was curious as to what conspiracies are against him? Maybe. Or maybe he was worried about things that he was actually doing, and he didn't want them to get out. Could that be a possibility? And I think if you ask some people, they don't believe that, unfortunately. So what I want to do today is start by talking about the first of the impeachments that we've seen in our country. And I'm going to throw, again, I'm going to throw Richard Nixon into that mix, even though he was not officially impeached. They had the impeachment articles drawn up. They were about ready to go forward. And then, of course, we had the smoking gun that happened, and that brought it all together. And at that point, Nixon knew his goose was cooked, and he resigned on the spot. So let's talk about the original, the OG impeached president, and that would be Andrew Johnson, the 17th president of the United States. Of course, he became president as a result of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. But it's interesting just how he even got into the position of being vice president. So he was born in 1808 in North Carolina. So he's born and raised in the South. He moved to Tennessee in his teen years, settled in Greenville, Tennessee, started his political run as a alderman in Greenville, and then became the mayor. He made it into the Tennessee state legislature by 1835 and lost re-election 2 years later. He returned to state politics in 1839 and then moved to the state Senate in 1841 and was elected to the U.S. House in 1843. Now, he then ran, and he was appointed to as a senator. And actually, no, I'm sorry. He, in 1853, so he got into the U.S. House in 1843. In 1853, his opponents gerrymandered him out of office, and he retaliated by electing governor. He was elected twice as governor in Tennessee. And then in 1857, he had gained enough support in the state legislature to be elected to the U.S. Senate. So back in those days, I think it was before in the early 1900s, there was an amendment to the Constitution that called for the senators to be elected by popular vote rather than by appointment of the state legislature. So at that point, it was still you were still appointed by the state legislature, so they were not directly elected. And so he was elected by the state legislature to the U.S. Senate. And he proved to be an independent thinker. Now, he was a social democrat, okay? Or a union, what they called a union Democrat back in those days. And so when Lincoln ran, because in, let's see, I want to make sure I get this right. So obviously he proved to be an independent thinker. Like I said, this was most evident following the 1860 election of Abraham Lincoln as president of the United States when Southern states began to secede. While the secession convention met in Charleston, South Carolina, Johnson addressed the Senate and proclaimed his allegiance to the Union. So remember, born and raised in the South, but he pledges allegiance to the Union. Tennessee did indeed secede, but Johnson remained in Washington. And Lincoln, in March of 1862, rewarded Johnson's loyalty with an appointment as military governor of Tennessee. When Lincoln sought a second presidential term in 1864, and needed the support of Union Democrats, like I had mentioned, he was a Union Democrat. He actually chose Johnson as his running mate, and he was made vice president on March 4th, 1865, upon the swearing in of Lincoln of his second term. And of course, 42 days later, we know what happened at the Ford Theater and the assassination of President Lincoln, and so Johnson became president. So the initial reaction to Johnson's presidency, despite the fact that the legislature was heavily Republican at the time, they were very optimistic about his ascendance to the presidency. Even the so-called radical Republicans who would pursue impeachment later, they supported him. Senator Bob Ben Wade of Ohio said, "By the gods, there will be no trouble now in running this government." But those relations quickly soured, as Johnson's views on Reconstruction surfaced. Within weeks, Johnson opposed political rights for freedmen and called for a lenient Reconstruction policy. So freedmen were, of course, former slaves. Including, he wanted to pardon, he even pardoned former Confederate leaders. The president looked for every opportunity to block the action of the radical Republicans who were very anti-South. They wanted to really nail them for the whole Civil War thing. And so that's kind of where this animosity came from. And Johnson had no interest in compromise. When Johnson vetoed the Freedmen's Bureau Bill in February of 1866, he broke the final ties of the Republican opponents in Congress. They responded with the 14th and 15th Amendments to the Constitution promising political rights to African Americans. In March of 1867, they also passed over Johnson's presidential veto, and this became key to the impeachment proceedings, the Tenure of Office Act, which was designed to limit the president's ability to shape his cabinet by requiring that he not only appointments but also dismissals be approved by the Senate. And obviously, you can see where this can be a problem. As a matter of fact, the Tenure of Office Act was deemed unconstitutional years later. Not necessarily in time to save Johnson from going through impeachment, but it certainly did. It certainly was found to be unconstitutional because it thwarted the authority of the president to assign the cabinet. That is one of the key rights of that's granted the Constitution. Of course, the Senate is granted confirmation, but the president can fire. And we've seen that recently with Jeff Sessions, right? He fired the attorney general, put Bill Barr in there, who was confirmed by the Senate. So if that had been the case and you had the opposite political party in place, he probably wouldn't have been able to fire Jeff Sessions. I don't think the Democrats would have allowed that to happen. I think the Republicans in the Senate would have allowed that today, and I don't think it would have made any difference. But nonetheless, it was declared unconstitutional. But the Tenure of Office Act became the key piece of legislation that ultimately led to the conflict that led to impeachment. So by mid-1867, Johnson's enemies in Congress were repeatedly promoting impeachment. The precipitant event that resulted in a third and successful impeachment action was the firing of Secretary of War Edwin M. Stanton, a Lincoln appointee, an ally of the radical Republicans in Congress. Stanton had strongly opposed Johnson's Reconstruction policies, and the president hoped to replace him with Ulysses S. Grant, whom Johnson believed to be more in line with his own political thinking. In August of 1867, while the Congress was in recess, Johnson suspended Stanton and appointed Grant as Secretary of War ad interim, so basically interim Secretary of War. When the Senate opposed Johnson's actions and reinstated Stanton in the fall under the Tenure of Office Act, Grant resigned, fearing punitive action and possible consequences for his own presidential ambitions, which obviously we know were fulfilled in the future. Furious with his congressional opponents, Johnson fired Stanton and informed Congress of his action and then named Major General Lorenzo Thomas, a longtime foe of Stanton, as interim secretary. Stanton promptly had Thomas arrested for illegally seizing his office. This musical chairs debacle amounted to a presidential challenge to the constitutionality of the Tenure of Office Act. In response, having again reinstated Stanton to office, radical Republicans in the House of Representatives, backed by key allies in the Senate, pursued impeachment. So led by an aging and ailing Thaddeus Stevens, the Joint Committee on Reconstruction rapidly drafted a resolution of impeachment, which passed the House on February 24th, 1868, by a vote of 126-47. Immediately, the House proceeded to establish an impeachment committee, appointed managers, and drafted articles of impeachment. The committee quickly produced charges that eventually became 11 articles of impeachment, and I'll read those what those were to you. Article 1, that said Andrew Johnson, President of the United States, on the 21st day of February in the year of our Lord, 1868, at Washington in the District of Columbia, unmindful of the high duties of his oath of office and of the requirements of the Constitution, that he should take care of the laws. He should take care of the laws, be faithfully let me look up the Cliff Notes version of these articles of impeachment rather than try to read the whole thing. But basically, let's see here. I will find this. Here we go. Here are the 11 articles of impeachment. Dismissing Edwin Stanton from office after the Senate had voted not to concur with the dismissal and had ordered him reinstated under their power granted to themselves on the Tenure of Office Act. Now, the Tenure of Office Act was vetoed by Johnson, of course, and it was overridden. Number two, appointing Thomas Secretary of War ad interim, despite the lack of vacancy in the office since the dismissal of Stanton had been invalid. Three, appointing Thomas without the required advice and consent of the Senate. Four, conspiring with Thomas and other persons to the House of Representatives unknown to unlawfully prevent Stanton from continuing in office. Five, conspiring to unlawfully curtail faithful execution of the Tenure of Office Act. Six, conspiring to seize, take, and possess the property of the United States and the Department of War. Seven, conspiring to seize, take, and possess the properties of the United States and the Department of War with specific intent to violate the Tenure of Office Act. Eight, is issuing to Thomas the authority of the Office of Secretary of War with unlawful intent to control the disbursements of the monies appropriated for the military service and for the Department of War. Nine, issuing to Major General William H. Emory orders with unlawful intent to violate federal law requiring all military orders to be issued through the General of the Army. Ten, making three speeches with intent to attempt to bring into disgrace, ridicule, hatred, contempt, and reproach the Congress of the United States. And 11, bringing disgrace and ridicule to the presidency by his aforementioned actions, words, and actions. Now, think about that. Think about those are the articles of incorporation or of impeachment that were passed. Okay. Especially thinking about those last two. Again, impeachment is not a criminal process. The only result of impeachment is removal from office. That is not a crime. That is not a criminal event. You don't get thrown. If you get impeached and ultimately the Senate removes you from office, that's all that happens to you. You can then be criminally prosecuted for things that you may have for acts you may have committed. And you'll recall, I don't want to talk about anywhere about Nixon because we're going to talk about that in a separate episode. We're going to go over that in detail. But the point is that the House of Representatives can impeach for pretty much any reason they want to. Basically, what numbers 10 and 11 are saying are things that are exactly happening today under President Trump. Attempt to bring into disgrace, ridicule, hatred, contempt, and reproach the Congress of the United States. And you could argue that Donald Trump does that almost on a weekly basis, right? I would say he does. Bringing disgrace and ridicule to the presidency by his aforementioned words and actions. He does that on Twitter daily, in the opinion of some. And right now, the majority opinion in Congress is that's exactly what he's doing. Now, there could be political consequences for doing this. As you recall, there were political consequences in the U.S. and in the House of Representatives when they impeached Bill Clinton. And we'll talk about Bill Clinton on here as well. So again, it's interesting that this is what exactly happened, but we talked about the 11 articles of impeachment. Some of the charges were petty, but mostly centered on the president's alleged violation of the Tenure of Office Act. So we talked about those different things. On March 2nd, 1868, the House approved the first 9 articles of impeachment, with the final 2 articles approved the following day. Amidst tremendous public attention and press coverage, the case moved to the Senate. Quickly, the Senate debated and adopted an updated set of 25 impeachment rules, setting the stage for the first presidential impeachment trial in U.S. history. Excuse me. With Chief Justice Salmon Chase presiding. The trial began on March 5th, 1868. On the advice of counsel, the president did not appear at the trial, although he did agree to a number of press interviews during the trial process. Leading the president's defense team was Attorney General Henry Stanberry, who resigned his post to devote all of his attention to the trial. Interesting that that said, right? Four well-known and highly respected lawyers also donated their services, including William M. Everts of New York, Benjamin R. Curtis of Boston, best known for his dissenting opinion in the Dred Scott case, Judge Thomas A.R. Nelson, an old friend of Johnson's from Tennessee, and William S. Groesbeck of Ohio. The defense presented a complicated argument designed to raise doubt about the senators' minds about Johnson's intent and to question the role of criminality in impeachable offenses. They argued that Johnson's actions had not violated the Tenure of Office Act. Since Stanton had been appointed by Lincoln, Johnson was not obligated to continue his service. Even if the senators accepted the act as constitutional, the defense team insisted Johnson could not be impeached for a mistaken interpretation of the law. Furthermore, they claimed that Johnson's intent was to test the very constitutionality of the act before the Supreme Court, which he had the right to do. The president, they insisted, should not be convicted and removed from office for misconstruing his constitutional rights. On the issue of appointing Thomas as interim officer, the defense team noted that Johnson was attempting by necessity to keep the War Department staffed and operational. The president's actions, they noted, had resulted in no public injury sufficiently yet grave to warrant removal from office. So the trial of the president included testimony of 25 prosecution and 16 defense witnesses. Became a public spectacle as well as a constitutional crisis. We've been hearing that word thrown around lately. And that's, again, why I'm talking about this, because this could be a road we end up going down. It gave the grand orators of the Senate a chance to dazzle the public with their speaking skills, and the trial was conducted mostly in open session before a packed gallery. During the final deliberations on the 11 articles of impeachment, however, the Senate cleared the gallery and closed the doors. Acknowledging the spectacular nature of the trial, the Senate opted to manage the overflow crowds by strictly controlling access to the visitors' gallery through a ticket system. So they did 1,000 tickets were printed, allowing admission for a single day. There was a process to that. So the sensational in every detail, the trial ended in a dramatic fashion. Johnson's fiercest opponents in the Senate maneuvered a vote on only three of the 11 articles of impeachment, believing those three offered the greatest chance to gain conviction. On May 16, 1868, in a dramatic call of the roll, 35 senators voted to convict the president of high crimes and misdemeanors, while 19 voted to acquit. A clear majority voted against the president, but the tally fell one vote short of the necessary two-thirds majority to convict. And that is an important point. The reason the Constitution was written in this way is that the framers believed that ultimately articles of impeachment could be very, very easy to come by, because you just need a simple majority vote in the House of Representatives to pass articles of impeachment that go on to the Senate. But actual conviction does take two-thirds of majority. And also keep in mind that originally senators were not directly voted in by the citizens. So it wasn't really a directly political office. They weren't accountable directly to voters, right? So the thought was, and remember, they would serve six-year terms. So the thought they were kind of insulated from the politics a little bit. Although, obviously, this became a very political debate, but it still came up short, because at the end of the day, what happened was there were seven of the 19 that voted to acquit were Republicans, and they defied their party to save the impeached president. And this is what was said by one of them. "I cannot agree to destroy the harmonious working of the Constitution for the sake of getting rid of an unacceptable president." In other words, they did not want to They did not want to destroy the power of the presidency for political reasons, because of political disagreements. Johnson ultimately didn't do anything wrong, because it was later found, as I stated earlier, that the Tenure of Office Act was indeed unconstitutional. And so that's why today the president had the right to fire Jeff Sessions and then appoint somebody new, who was then confirmed by the Senate. Under the Tenure of Office Act, he would have had to have permission from the Senate in order to fire Jeff Sessions. Now, he probably would have gotten the votes to get that, and probably would have been a moot point. But the point is that the president still has the right to run the executive branch the way he sees fit. And that was what was happening here. And the senators were taking the stance of going, you know what? Yeah, he violated this act, and maybe there's other ways we can get around this, and we've made our point, kind of. But at the end of the day, I think they even felt that maybe there's some unconstitutionality here. And there was enough Republicans that felt that way that indeed did vote to acquit the president at the time. So he served out his term as president, leaving office on March 4th, 1869. He then became a senator once again in 1864 or in 1874, was actually in the chamber. He was elected to the very chamber that where he'd been tried and acquitted just a few years earlier, but he only served 3 months before his death on July 31st, 1875. So it's again, the point is that impeachment is a political process, and the Democrats are really weighing it right now whether there's enough there or not. And the reason they're doing that is because they don't want it to be petty. There's a sanctity to that process that some would argue was a little bit violated by Republicans back in 1998 when they impeached Bill Clinton, because it was quote unquote just about sex, which is funny because now 20 years later, the Democrats are the big pushers of the Me Too movement, right? It's more of a Democrat thing than a Republican thing, right? Especially since they're using it against Supreme Court nominees. But again, I think the Democrats are looking at this process. Impeachment is a serious business. And I think that there is a thought that from a lot of congressional leaders that, hey, we're only going to impeach if we think we can get conviction. They're kind of like the prosecutor. They're kind of like the grand jury. We're only going to press charges if we believe we can get a conviction. And a conviction in a Republican Senate is very, very, is a very, very tall order. And I think they also still believe that they're ultimately going to get the White House back in 2020. They're confident that Donald Trump will be a one-term president, and therefore, why take the risk of impeachment and really empowering his base and costing them election in 2020, because they know that they're not going to get a conviction in the Senate. They know that. So why try it? Now, in the event that he does get elected in 2020 and somehow the Democrats hold on to the House, which I think they probably might, and at that point, I think they'll also get a hold of the Senate, because the 2020 election does not line up well for Republicans, then they may try it again. That's when they may try it. It's during a second term when he's a lame duck. But again, looking at history and how that can hurt your political party, that may be a tall order. So that's the history on the first ever presidential impeachment. And we're going to next time talk about President Richard Nixon and the Watergate and how that all went down. So we'll talk about that. But that's it for this episode of the Moderate Podcast. Again, remember to visit our website at themoderatepodcast.com. We got a lot of stuff there. We have a lot of links and things like that, in addition to kind of put the show into context. So I really hope you'll check it out there. Things that you won't see on Facebook and Twitter, only if you go to the website, is where the only place you'll find that. But we are, nonetheless, on Twitter at TheModPodcast1. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/TheModeratePodcast. And again, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, please make sure you leave us a voice message. I'd love to hear from you, and hopefully maybe even be able to use some of your audio on a future episode, and Anchor makes it very easy for you to do it, so hopefully check that out. Anyway, until next time, I'm Jimmy Davis. Keep it real.